The holidays are all about sharing with family. Meals, couches, stories, grandma's secret pecan pie recipe. And now, you can also share a cart with Instacart's family carts. Everyone can add what they want to one group cart from wherever they are. So you don't have to go from room to room to find out who wants cranberry sauce, or who should get mini marshmallows for the yams, or collecting votes for sugar cookies versus shortbread. Just share a cart and then share the meals and the moments. Download the Instacart app and get delivery in as fast as 30 minutes. Plus, enjoy free delivery on your first three orders. Service fees and terms apply.
This holiday, BMW has reunited three members of the family at the BMW Roadhome Sales Event. The Agile X3, engineered for any adventure. The plug-in hybrid X5, commanding the streets with unmatched presence. And the all-electric i4, charging into the future with impeccable performance. Hurry in to find what powers your journey at the BMW Roadhome Sales Event. BMW, the ultimate driving machine. Hurry in for exceptional offers through January 2nd. Visit BMWUSA.com for details.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Welcome back. Chunkies coming to you live on 106.7 The Fan and the Team 980 here in the DMV. 910 The Fan, 105.1 FM in Richmond. We're streaming live on the free Odyssey app. You can watch us on Monumental Sports Network, brought to you by Crop Metcalf, the official heating and cooling company of the Junkies. We're packed today. Chris Doering joins us coming
next
up
segment
in 20 minutes to talk some college football. You have the quarterfinals coming up in the college football playoffs. It's a Friday. That means John Feinstein, Ed Cooley, Georgetown head basketball coach, are off to a great start. He'll join us at 8:20. Scott Abraham on the Commanders at 9. But when you hear this music, that means our pal Kevin McCarthy joins us. Hey, Kevin.
It's time to get Rick. What's going on, Rick?
I don't know how you're going to get through this segment without EB peppering you with questions.
Wait, is Eric even there today?
There's no Eric, no cake.
This is a two-man show.
It's two-man shows, JP and Bish.
I don't know how you're going to get through it. You're used to, you know, Eric is so involved in the segment.
I know. He asks so many profound questions. I mean, if you watch my interviews, where do you think I get my interview style from? I get it from him, Eric Bickle.
Yeah.
the profound and deep questions that he asks me in the segment, that's where I learned it.
It's very
from,
similar. Very similar. How was your Christmas, by the way?
It was, Jason, thank you for asking. It was a very nice question. It was very good. I did it with my family.
Did you go down where's your family live? Virginia Beach?
No, well, they're all over. My mom and dad are down near Williamsburg. My grandmother's down in like Yorktown area. My brother's in Chesapeake.
Gotcha.
But yeah, all that area. But no, I actually spent it up here with some family because I actually had to work Monday and Tuesday, Thursday, Friday. So what about you guys?
Got through it, man.
Yep. And now, but there's some big movies coming out this weekend. I don't know where you want to start.
The Bob Dylan movie, I'm guessing.
I'll start with the Bob Dylan movie. Yeah, I mean, I don't know how interested you guys are in this movie, but like, even if you're not really a huge Bob Dylan fan, it's just one of those films that really kind of captures the magic of performance and filmmaking, because Timothée Chalamet, like this kid, he became Bob Dylan. And I think Edward Norton was talking about this recently, how it's kind of an impossible role to play Bob Dylan. I mean, from what I understand, he performed live 40 songs when they were making the movie. I don't think all 40 made the film itself, but every time you see him playing in the film, he's playing live. Mm-hmm. So he plays the guitar, he sings, he plays the harmonica, he speaks like him, he holds himself like Bob Dylan. It's one of those performances that I don't really understand how it's possible. As somebody who's played guitar all my life, you know, you can learn to be musically talented in certain aspects, but I think some of that stuff you're born with.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how you guys feel about that, but I feel like there's certain talent you can't teach. And you know, like I can't, you know, not everybody can sing like Beyonce or sing like Taylor Swift or, you know, sing like Billie Eilish or, and so I think when you hear Timothée Chalamet playing him, it's almost like a magic trick. It's like, how is that possible? Because when you watch him perform the Dylan songs, it's as if Dylan is doing it. I mean, this is, I think this is 1961 and 1965 of Dylan's career. So Edward Norton plays Pete Seeger, who's kind of an integral part to getting Dylan into the folk music scene and kind of getting him heard. Mm-hmm. And Monica Barbaro, who you might know from Top Gun Maverick, she plays Joan Baez. Her performance is remarkable. Everybody's live singing. Everybody's playing. And the guy who directed it did like 310 to Yuma. He did Walk the Line, obviously, with the Johnny Cash film. Boyd Holbrook plays Johnny Cash in this new movie. Obviously, you know, Joaquin Phoenix played him in Walk the Line. But it's remarkable. And James Mangold did a great job. You know, he also directed Copland. You guys love Copland. Great film. I loved it. I was blown away by it. There's a few moments where I think it's a little bit of like a, you know, not that it's a biopic, because it's a very specific time of Dylan's life, but there's a few moments where it kind of locks into that Hollywood-style storyline where, like, you watch people react while he's playing and they're, like, they're discovering him. It's a little kind of cheesy at times. But overall, I thought it was just remarkable in terms of its storytelling. And I think Chalamet, I think it's one of the best performances I've ever seen. And I don't say that lightly. Wow. I know it's a really bold statement. But it is, I'm telling you, it's almost as if, it's hard to explain. When I was a kid, I would go to magic shows. And I remember seeing David Copperfield live when I was younger. And I think that's kind of why I love movies so much, because movies are magic tricks, and movies are, and filmmakers are magicians. And you buy into the trick. And if it's done well enough, you suspend your disbelief and you believe what you're watching. That's the whole point. And then the moment a filmmaker makes a mistake, that's when you kind of like look at your phone, or you look away, or you remember you're watching a movie. There was not a single moment in this movie where I forgot that I was watching a movie. Like, I was looking, I thought I was watching Bob Dylan. I thought I was watching footage that was resurfaced from the 60s. That's how good he is.
Did he talk about how much he actually watched Dylan perform and just to sound like him? I mean, he must have watched him for, I mean, months.
Well, that's the weird thing. So this particular process, it took him 6 years.
Oh, my gosh.
So there's footage of him on the set of the first Dune, which I think was like 2019, 2020, where he was practicing these songs in his Dune costume in the trailer in between the scenes. I mean, you're filming Dune's one of the biggest movies of all time, and he's sitting there working on this. I think that the process on this got halted by the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And I think that gave him more time. And then they shot the film this year. Mm. I mean, they shot this thing this year. So he had like, and to answer your question, I think he purposely kept himself from later Dylan stuff. And he only focused on the stuff through 61 to 65. So like Blowing in the Wind and the Times They Are Changing and like all these, like, you know, some of Dylan's best work. But I'm even if you're not a Dylan fan, if you just want to see like your magic, like somebody becoming somebody, it's like, I honestly think it's better than what Joaquin Phoenix did with Johnny Cash. And like, I think it's a great performance as well, but this is one of the best performances I've ever seen. Like,
so when did Chalamet start playing guitar? You probably already said that.
I don't know. So that's the thing. I'm trying to think of his history. I don't think he knew how to play to this extent. I mean, remember, he's playing guitar, playing harmonica,
yeah,
and singing all live.
So like, maybe he started like, at like the same time. He was probably 5-6 years ago.
Yeah, I know. I think I started this process like 5-6 years ago. I don't know if he ever picked up a guitar before. And as a kid, maybe he did, but yeah, to this extent.
It's kind of crazy.
So 4.5 for the Timothée Chalamet
movie. A complete
movie.
Unknown, yeah.
Let's get complete to unknown. Nicole Kidman's movie, which I believe is called Baby Girl. And I hear there's some tawdry elements to this movie.
Yeah, so I know we only have... Wait, what was the word you used?
Tawdry.
Well, what is that? I've never heard that word before.
No, I didn't want to use sexy. You want me to look up the definition?
No, I've just never heard that
cheap,
word.
Cheap, poor quality, I don't know.
I only
erotic.
Have five
this
minutes.
Is called it erotic.
Yeah. Erotic, yeah. All right, so we have 5 minutes. I'm going to do quick on this one. Okay. So Nicole Kidman basically plays a high-powered CEO who essentially puts everything on the line, her life, her family, her career, to have an affair with an intern played by Harris Dickinson. And, you know, it's an interesting concept because Nicole Kidman is she's so good in the film, and Harris Dickinson is so good in the film. But the movie kind of juggles this interesting tone where it's like playful but serious, but also intense, but also comedic. And it kind of leans into the awkwardness of kind of what this situation would be like. But the whole idea of the film is, you know, submission and control, and the character wants to be controlled in a way, but also submit in a way. And it's a very interesting kind of balance. And obviously, I think a lot of people are tying this to, like, people are thinking about Eyes Wide Shut, not that they're similar movies, but the idea of, like, kind of an erotic thriller in a way. Eyes Wide Shut was a really wild film, Stanley Kubrick. But Nicole Kidman is, you know, she's fantastic in it, and so is Harris Dickinson. I didn't think the movie was as solid as the performances. I do think that she does a great job, and I think the direction's great, and it's shot well and scored well. And I think the themes work really well. But overall, I found it a bit underwhelming considering the thematics it was dealing with. I think it was tonally a little off at times, but
yeah.
I thought it was okay. I gave it a 3.5 out of 5. It's, you know, it's definitely not one that I'd run out to see, but it's definitely stirring up a lot of conversation.
It seems like it would be awkward just because the actor's ages. I mean, she's almost 60 and he's, what is he, 27? I think he's 27 or 28, and she's 57 or 58. So that's a huge difference.
She still looks good.
I mean,
though.
Ages,
oh yeah,
the ages aren't necessarily like what make it awkward. It's more about like the CEO and
the
intern
power struggle.
Aspect of it.
Sure.
Yeah, no, I'm just talking about the actors.
All right, Kevin.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, to ask Nicole Kidman to have sex scenes with a 27-year-old. I mean,
she might be sized.
Maybe she is. I don't know.
All right, I only got a couple minutes here. You have a third movie that you saw, right?
Yeah, no, it's Nosferatu. It's essentially a remake of a 102-year-old movie. And so the first one came out in 1922, and now this one is massive. This is going to be one of the biggest movies of the weekend, and essentially Bill Skarsgård plays the legendary Nosferatu character that's a vampire, and essentially Lily Rose Depp's character is being summoned by him, essentially. And honestly, like, it's one of those movies that like is technically brilliant. Like the cinematography, the scares are brutal, the violence is brutal. But I didn't find the overarching story to be as interesting as the imagery. I think Nicholas Hoult is fantastic in the movie, and I do think that there's some really great scares. I think Lily Rose Depp is phenomenal. It's Johnny Depp's daughter. And the physicality of her performance, the way she has to do these possession scenes, essentially her character's having nightmares that's connecting her to Nosferatu and essentially, you know, wanting him to, you know, to come to her. And it's just, you know, it's interesting. I think a lot of people are excited about this movie because Robert Eggers, the filmmaker, he did The Lighthouse and he did The Witch. Great director. But I didn't think that this one was as solid as like The Witch and The Lighthouse. It works, but I didn't think it worked extremely well. I think the imagery and the visuals and the cinematography and the music are way better than the actual storytelling.
Mm.
But
so
I think
what's
the visual
rating?
Effects.
3.5?
I'm at a 3.5 out of 5, yeah.
All right, so you're 4.5 for Complete Unknown, 3.5 for the other two. Correct?
Yes, sir.
All right.
Yes, sir.
All right, Kevin.
All right, bro.
Happy New Year.
Have a good New Year, man.
Happy holidays, guys.
Happy holidays,
bud. It's a great Kevin McCarthy from Fox 5. You go to his Instagram page, Kevin McCarthy TV. We were talking about this during the break.
Mm-hmm.
He has tons of videos with millions of views. Because he's got all these interviews with celebrities.
Right. I mean, travels all over the world doing it.
He's become big time. All right, coming up next, we're going to dive into the college football playoffs. It's quarterfinals time. Chris Doering joins us from the SEC Network. here on The Junkies.
I'm Anna Garcia with True Crime News, the podcast. Every crime tells a story. Every story demands justice. True Crime News, the podcast, covers breaking crimes, investigating high-profile and under-the-radar cases. Every week, we dive beyond the headlines, exploring the effects of violent crimes on victims and search for justice. We hope you join us as your weekly source for true crime news. Listen to and follow True Crime News, the podcast, on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Got a packed show today. John Feinstein is going to join us at 8 o'clock. We talk to the best-selling author every Friday at 8 o'clock. Ed Cooley, Georgetown basketball coach, joins us at 8:20. And then we got Scott Abraham from ABC7 joining us at 9. Plus, we have our touchdown parlay. We'll get to that coming up at 7:45. Going to get to Chris Doering here momentarily. Jason's like texting Valdez behind the scenes as we're trying to track him down. You have three college football quarterfinals coming up on January 1st with one on New Year's Eve. So Penn State plays Boise State. That's 3-6 in the Fiesta Bowl. So they're still attaching the quarterfinals names to bowls. Notre Dame takes on Georgia. That's the Sugar Bowl. Ohio State against Oregon. That's 1-8. That's Rose Bowl. And then Texas, Arizona State, the Chick-fil-A Peach Bowl.
So these will be on neutral fields. The weather won't be an issue, unlike the first round. But, and the matchup should be a little bit better. We had four blowouts in the first round. And I think a lot of that had to do with just the environments. You know, Penn State just had a clear advantage in that game over SMU.
It's crazy that the college football season is going to end January 20th.
Yes.
I mean, it's been a while that it's changed beyond January 1st. But growing up, it ended on January 1st.
You're going to have a game on New Year's Eve, okay? And then you're going to have three on New Year's Day. And they are kind of spreading them out. Mm-hmm. And like you said, the New Year's or the semifinals game will be on the 10th and then the championship game on the 20th. So there's just a huge spread between each of these games, which, that could be good, could be bad. I don't know. We'll see.
All right, joining us right now is Chris Doering, college football analyst for the SEC Network, co-host SEC This Morning on Sirius XM. Chris, did you play in four bowls?
Yeah, man. We didn't have losing seasons at Florida, bro. What are you talking about?
What were your four bowls?
We went to the Deer Bowl in my freshman year, and then went to two Sugar Bowls, which went to the champion of the SEC at that time, and then my senior year played in the national championship game in the Fiesta Bowl, which was right when they were making that change to the early, I guess it was before the BCS or whatever it was before that, maybe. I don't remember.
Yeah. But yeah. That's a pretty good run.
Three major bowls. Yeah.
That's a pretty good run. Could you imagine, though, going through this gauntlet where, you know, let's say you're Ohio State, you know, you can win a national championship, you got to win four games.
I would have loved it. I mean, that's what competitors want to do. Like, competitors want to have a chance to play in big games. They want to have a chance to play the best competition. There was a time that everybody, remember, argued about, they're playing too many games or the season goes too long. Yeah, forget all that. the NCAA is hypocritical as hell because, you know, right now we got the stupid ass. You watched that bowl game last night with Pitt and Toledo or whoever it was.
Yeah.
Six overtimes, and after you get into the third one, you get that goofy two-point play that decides that, like, we're really trying to save a few plays here and there for the odd instances where a game goes into multiple overtimes. I think it's a stupid rule, and I think it's another sign of hypocrisy. We're worried about a few plays here and there, but we're going to let guys play 17 or 18 games in a season to win a championship.
Yeah, you're right. Hey, how well do you know Kirk Herbstreit?
I know him decently. I mean, you know, I've obviously work for the same company, and we've been in the same lines of work for a long time. I love Kirk.
Yeah, I figured you did. I like him too. I wanted to get your thoughts on his comments that he said a few days ago about about Indiana getting in. He called it BS that Indiana got in. He said the committee's got to do a better job of weighing who the best 12 teams are and who the most deserving are, besides the most wins. And he said they didn't beat anybody, but they got 11 wins, so they got in. you know, and we heard Lane Kiffin make some comments. I guess that was on social media after the first round because he had four blowouts, and you know he clearly wanted to get in. Alabama clearly wanted to get in. I think those teams were probably better teams, and I want to get your thoughts on this. I don't know if they were more deserving based on the fact that they had bad losses. I mean, Ole Miss losing to Kentucky. Kentucky had one conference win. I'm sorry, that's a horrible loss. Alabama losing to Vanderbilt. Okay, Vanderbilt was better this year, but it's still a bad loss. Bama should never lose to Vanderbilt, and they should never only score 3 points in a game against Oklahoma. So your thoughts on Herb Street's comments about Indiana getting in over some of these other blue bloods?
I mean, you just summarized the argument in a sentence there. You know, I think they're the best team, but I don't know if they're the most deserving. And I think that's the timeless answer that we've the question that we've asked as we've talked about, you know, the original 14 playoff field and now the 12 team playoff field. And honestly, you know, there's a lot of people that were saying, well, you know, these first round games are blowouts. The margin of victory is very similar to what it was in the first round games of the 14 playoffs that we had before. Mm-hmm. But nothing really changes. And ironically, you know, some people have said, oh, we need to contract the field. It doesn't need to be 12 teams. Well, I think it needs to be quite the opposite. It needs to be 14 or probably even 16 teams because there were some teams there on the outside, Ole Miss, South Carolina, Alabama, that I think would have fared well in the playoff, that could have competed better than maybe Indiana did or what SMU did. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, like, it's not a setup. You can't mirror the NFL because it's very different with conferences and the way that schedules are built. And, you know, not all conferences are the same. Not all wins are the same. So the committee has a tough task, and it's funny because people were so pissed off about the BCS situation and what they had to do with using computers and that you needed to have some sort of human element to it. Now everybody wants to add the computers back into it. I guess we've got a fascination with AI now, but you know, maybe there's a way to integrate some of the computers into what we're doing with the committee. If you would have used a BCS-type system this year, it would have been very similar to what the committee came up with. So I don't know what the answer is, but I do know that I don't think that I could have seen Indiana or SMU winning a game in this tournament.
Right.
But I damn sure think Alabama or SMU or Ole Miss probably could have won a game. And I think that goes back to your question about, you know, who are the best teams that we're trying to gather for this tournament.
Yeah. Just kind of watching College game day before the Penn State SMU game, Kevin Jennings, the quarterback at SMU, you could tell he was uncomfortable. I mean, that atmosphere.
The weather.
Yeah, he was, all those guys, it was just frigid, right? And I think the same thing happened with Tennessee, CD. I don't know if you agree with this, but Nico is, you know, he's a West Coast guy. You know, he plays in Knoxville. He's not used to that type of weather. It was 8 degrees in the Ohio State game. Now, Ohio State was just better. But offensively, he looked lost. The entire offense looked affected by the weather and the environment. Same with SMU. So I think the fact that these teams were able to play those home games was a huge advantage, especially in the cold weather.
I do think home field matters. I do love that aspect of the new expanded playoff. I do think we should get the 16, and I think we should let all the first-round teams have home games, mm-hmm. or the first-round playoff games be held in home sites. Actually, I heard a pretty unique idea in that, hey, if we want to keep the bowls integrated, let's play the first round games in the bowl sites, and then let's play the next round games at home so they can really be a determining factor in the outcome of those more meaningful games as we move on in the second round. Honestly, I disagree with you, though, bro, as it relates to
the weather.
Ohio State would have kicked their ass.
Oh, either way, yeah.
In
okay.
Columbus, in Hawaii, in Knoxville. I mean,
you're probably right. Yeah, you're right.
I was there. I was on the sideline. Both lines of scrimmage. And when you can get pressure with only four rushers, when you can control the line of scrimmage, when you can stop the run game with four, it makes it impossible to do anything else offensively. Now, let's go back to, I mean, Tennessee ends up losing Dylan Sampson early in that ball game. Mm-hmm. Dante Thornton goes out. Squirrel White gets injured. I mean, they were down a bunch of pieces. But the offensive and defensive line domination by Ohio State was the difference in that ball game. You know, I didn't think that Nico played great, but I don't think anybody on that offense for Tennessee played well. And so I
That is the biggest question I left the horseshoe with on Saturday was how in the hell did they lose to Michigan? I mean, this is an extremely talented team, and I understand why Ohio State fans are so frustrated with the four consecutive losses to Michigan. When you have a team like that, I understand that that can be very frustrating to lose to an inferior team, particularly at home. But at the same time, man, I think Ryan Day's done a really good job of accumulating talent and accumulating talent on the coaching staff. Chip Kelly had a tremendous game plan put together for Tennessee, and they executed it really well. I thought Will Howard was a game manager at best. He was far from that on Saturday.
He was great. All right, so your thoughts on Notre Dame, Georgia. All right, so Georgia's got their backup quarterback starting. Gunnar Stockton's going to start, and he played in the SEC championship game after Beck got hurt. He was pretty good. He did throw a pick, but he was 12 for 16. He made enough plays, and then the defense was just really good and getting after Quinn Ewers. So, but Notre Dame, they can get after you. They've got pros that can run the hell out of the ball. They're one of the best running teams in the country. Your thoughts on Notre Dame, Georgia. Georgia's a slight favorite, laying about 2. The total's 43.5.
Yeah, it's interesting to see Georgia as an underdog in this ball game, isn't it? And obviously, it reflects a lot on Carson Beck. You know what I saw in that game, though, in the SEC championship against Texas, was something for the first time all year long, and that was the players around the quarterback elevating their play. I think for so long, everybody's looked at Carson Beck in that huddle as the guy with the cape that can make all the plays, and so they kind of just defer to him. Obviously, they're down. You know, their tight end and receiver, Brock Bowers and Ladd McConkey, are two of the best rookie players in the NFL right now. And so you're down those guys. It was uncomfortable for Carson Beck. You got receivers that can't catch a lick out there dropping ball after ball. But when Gunnar Stockton came in, you saw the other guys elevate their play, understand that if they're going to win, they have to play better. So I think those players tapped into another level and realized, you know, kind of what they're going to have to do to play well now that Carson Beck is out. But I also, at the same time, think it's an interesting question about Mike Bobo, the offensive coordinator. Is it an advantage for Georgia now to be able to game plan knowing that it's going to be Gunnar Stockton going forward and drop the plan specific to his skill set? Or is it an advantage for Notre Dame having seen what Mike Bobo wants to do with Gunnar Stockton and the way they used him differently, the way they got him outside of the pocket on some of the throws more so than what they do with Carson Beck, or how they used it in quarterback run game? That was one of the things that he had a lot of success with in the second half of the game against Texas. Mm-hmm. So I do think that'll be an interesting question. But anytime your backup gets a chance to have all of the snaps in practice and get real comfortable with the game plan, it's got to be an advantage for you. So I do think that this is going to be a fantastic ball game. Notre Dame is extremely physical, but there's nobody more physical in this tournament than what Georgia is. And I guarantee you the last couple of weeks, Kirby Smart has emphasized the need for that offensive line to play more physical, for the running backs to be able to contribute more, to take more off the quarterback's shoulders, the defense to be more aggressive. So it's a bad matchup for Notre Dame as it relates to the physicality of what I expect Georgia to bring. But the fact that you are playing with a backup quarterback now is a question mark. I think Georgia wins the game, but I think it's going to be an absolute low-scoring slugfest.
Talking to Chris Doering, who, of course, covers college football for the SEC Network, co-hosts SEC This Morning on Sirius XM. Now, these aren't SEC teams, but I want to get your take on the Penn State-Boise State game. When you look at their seasons, Penn State lost in the Big Ten Championship to Oregon. Boise State's only loss was to Oregon way back in September. They lost by a field goal. How do you see this one playing out?
You know, I would be disingenuous if I tried to get into the weeds here on Boise. I've watched Boise casually this year. Mm-hmm. But I was really impressed with Penn State on Saturday. I think a lot of people, including myself, discount the job that James Franklin has done at Penn State. That was a great environment, man. That was awesome. That was one of the things that we had hoped for in seeing home playoff games, the fans showing up and the whiteout. I know it was a noon game, but they did make a difference in that mm-hmm. ball game. The weather did make a difference with mm-hmm. Kevin Jennings and SMU. This one will be at a neutral site, so a little different dynamic there. But I was really impressed with Penn State. and their defense was absolutely smothering, getting the two pick sixes. Ashton Jeanty is the guy when it comes to Boise and their offense. The number one game plan has got to be stop him and make somebody else beat you. You know, I think Penn State's the better team here, but I love that matchup between the Boise run game and Penn State, what they do defensively.
Yeah, I think that Tom Allen, who's the defensive coordinator for Penn State, is going to basically tell Maddox Mattson, the quarterback at Boise, all right, you're going to beat us. Jeanty ain't beating us. You know what I mean? So they're going to load that up. Yeah. And by the way, Abdul Carter is just a sick, sick talent for Penn State. Yeah. He's unbelievable. He's going to be all over the place. All right, real quick, I just wanted to ask you about the portal. We were talking a little bit earlier about Jim Larrañaga, the head basketball coach at Miami. He steps down. I'm sure you heard that. And he basically said, you know what? I'm 75. I'm exhausted. I can't deal with NIL and portal. The football portal is crazy. I told this story earlier in the show that Darian Mensah, CD, I don't know if you heard this, but Darian Mensah, who was the quarterback at Tulane, he was a freshman, had a pretty good year, and they played in the conference championship and lost to Army. He transferred to Duke. All right. Mm-hmm. He's getting $4 million per year for 2 years at Duke. So he's going to get $8 million, and that's just Duke. You know, it's a basketball school. And I was just kind of looking at the portal tracker and some of these guys that are transferring, especially into the SEC. You know, the kid, Jackson Arnold, who's going from Oklahoma to Auburn. I mean, I can't even imagine what he's getting. The kid that's going from, I think it's a Kelby Downs, is that his name? From Florida. Isn't he transferring to another SEC school? I think he is.
Oh, Kelby Collins?
Kelby Collins, I'm sorry. Kelby Collins, yeah. I just, what kind of money is out there, especially for the quarterbacks?
I have a hard time believing that this is sustainable. Yep. You know, it used to be the frustration that I had was that, you know, you got these kids that are coming out of high school that haven't even played a down of college football that are getting paid a bunch of money. And, oh, by the way, you're not supposed to be paying for play, or you're not supposed to be giving kids recruiting inducements to come to your school, which clearly is happening everywhere, along with roster tampering and everything else. But now we're talking about guys that haven't even been good in college football.
Exactly.
To play.
Yeah.
Like if you play the quarterback position and you've ever been thought of as being good, you can go cash a massive lottery ticket. So yeah, it's not sustainable. I mean, business people have all this money to get to these collectives because they're good business people, because they expect a return on their investment. I don't know what kind of investment return they're getting right now. Look at the Grove Collective in Oxford, Mississippi, was one of the best collectives in all of college football last offseason, raised a ton of money. What do they have to show? But they didn't even have a playoff appearance to show for it.
Right,
you know? So
right.
At some point in time, these guys have to have some sort of desire to get a return. And how much longer are you going to continue to give that money when it's being wasted on you know, going to a bowl game instead of a college football playoff game?
Yeah. I mean, John Mateer, who was at Washington State, going to Oklahoma, who knows what he's getting. And you mentioned Kelby Downs, Kelby Collins. He's a defensive end. He's going from Florida to Alabama. I mean, you know he's getting sick money. I mean, he might not be getting what quarterbacks are getting, but he's getting stupid money. And like you said, Jackson Arnold, he got benched at Oklahoma. And he's getting paid at Auburn. It's, man, the system is just crazy.
You guys see it. It happens in the NFL, too, where, you know, guys are first-round picks. Yeah. And they don't really work out in their first spot. They go into free agency and somebody else pays them because they were thought of as being this great talent coming out. Everybody loves potential, and that's certainly the case in college football.
All right, before we let you go, who's your national championship?
I got Georgia and Oregon, although that's what I did in the preseason. But after witnessing what there's no doubt Ohio State's beating Oregon this week. I mean, they were close when they played the first time in Eugene. They're playing with a lot of confidence now. I think they met, obviously, probably the best accumulated roster talent wise. So I'm gonna change up what I put in the preseason. I'm gonna go Georgia, Ohio State.
There you go. Georgia, Ohio State.
All right, bro. Thanks for joining us, man. Hope you had a good Christmas.
Happy New Year. Great to be on. Happy New Year, guys.
Yeah,
Happy New Year.
We'll talk to you soon, man.
Bye-bye. It's our pal Chris Doering, known him since his days playing wide receiver for Steve Spurrier in Washington for the Redskins back then when we were on HFS, I believe.
Imagine what Chris Doering would be making in the portal if he, you know, catching 20 touchdowns in a season.
Tons.
Yeah.
Tons. Because he was the SEC, like, all-time leader, right,
in
receptions?
Yeah, he put up some stupid numbers.
Still on the show, we've got Ed Cooley joining us at 8:20 from Georgetown. Scott Abraham from ABC 7 at 9. John Feinstein at 8. But next, our touchdown parlay
here on the Junkies.
Hey, we should mention next month from now, you can join us for a special live show, 106.7 The Fan Live. It's the Junkies, B. Mitch and Finley, Grant and Danny. It's an uncensored show. We did this last year. It was a fun time. We're going to be talking behind the scenes, working radio, preview the Super Bowl, talk about the Commander season and more. You can hang out with all of us for a night of fun. Tickets are on sale now at tallyhotheater.com, and it's on January 31st. I believe it's a Friday night. Let me double check.
I think so. I think you're right.
Friday, January 31st, Tally Ho Theater. So I hope you can join us. Go to tallyhotheater.com to get your tickets because they will go fast. All right, when you hear that music, that means time for our parlay. We hit two early in the season. I feel like we are due. There's only four of us. I think this is a good opportunity to make a little cash.
All right.
By the way, we've talked about this before, but I'm not sure. If the four of us hit, do the other guys get a cut?
No.
No, they're out.
They're done.
Okay.
They're not contributing.
Yeah, but like early in the season, we split it with all the boys behind the glass, even though only one guy made the pick.
Yeah, no.
Oh, well, that's what we're all present.
Team players.
Team players.
We definitely can't give it to guys who
are not. We're not giving it to them when they're not here.
Yeah, when they're on vacay, when they're sleeping in.
Okay.
Yeah.
They're all sleeping right now. 7:50 a.m.
I just wanted to make that clear because I feel like we got a good shot.
Now I'm going to put the parlay in on my FanDuel account, and these are all FanDuel numbers. So, JP, why don't you start us off?
All right, I'm going to lead off. You know what? Early in the season, no, really throughout the season, everybody was talking about Malik Nabers. He is the best wide receiver rookie out of LSU. There's a guy named Brian Thomas Jr. who's making an argument for best receiver, rookie receiver. Brian Thomas Jr., if you look at the last month in particular, he's got four touchdowns in the last month. Last week against the Raiders, targeted 13 times, 9 catches, 132, and a score. You go the week before against the Jets, targeted 14 times, 10 catches, 105 yards, and 2 touchdowns. The week before that, targeted 12 times. They target him a lot. Doesn't matter who's under center, who's throwing the ball. They're going to go to Brian Thomas Jr. early and often. I think the rookie gets in the end zone.
All right, he's plus 125 to score a touchdown. What a terrible matchup. Titans, Jags, Mason Rudolph against Mac Jones. But Mac Jones likes to sling it around, so he'll be looking for Brian Thomas. I like it. All right, I'll go next. The Cincinnati Bengals are playing a pretty big game this weekend against the Broncos. You know, maybe it's a long shot for the Bengals to get into the playoffs, but it's still a meaningful game for them. They have to win out, and a bunch of other stuff has to happen to catch the teams like the Broncos. But it's a big matchup because they would have the head-to-head against the Broncos for one of those last wild card spots. They play at 4:30 tomorrow, so there's a triple header tomorrow. And they are the middle game on NFL Network. That's Denver.
I'm sleeping on the Saturday games.
Yeah, you are.
Three Saturday games.
Triple header. And they all are meaningful because the Chargers need to win. They're playing New England. Obviously, just mentioned the Broncos and Bengals. And then the Rams are playing the Cardinals. So if you look at what T. Higgins has done the last few weeks, he got 11 targets last week against Cleveland. He had 8 catches, 58 yards, scored a touchdown. The week before, he had 8 targets, 5 catches, 88 yards, scored a touchdown. He scored a touchdown in 5 of the last 6 games. So, obviously, Ja'Marr Chase is the guy that Burrow likes to throw to, but it's such explosive offense. He throws to everybody, and he's throwing the ball a lot to T. Higgins as well. I like T. Higgins to score his 6th touchdown in his last 7 games, and that number currently is plus 150 against Denver. So, I like now he's going against a tough secondary, but I like T. Higgins to get into the end zone plus 150 tomorrow afternoon.
Joe Burrow doesn't care about a tough secondary.
You're right. I like it. I like him. Plus 150. All right.
All right. So we got 2 wide receivers in so far.
Yeah.
Brian Thomas Jr. and T. Higgins.
All right. Let's go to Mike Moore
first. Are we gonna go all wide receivers?
No, we are not.
Nope. I'm going to buck the train here. We're going Zach Ertz to score plus 250. He's coming off his little spat with that bum Nick Sirianni last week post-game. Hasn't scored since the Titans game, but prior to that, he scored in three consecutive games, and he's gotten seven or more targets in five games this year. Let's get Zach back on track under the bright lights.
All right.
Yeah, that was an interesting story about Sirianni and Ertz.
What a doofus he is, Sirianni.
That Sirianni apparently didn't like the fact that Ertz gave him a hard high five. Is that what it was?
Yeah. I have audio of, I guess, Odyssey's Philly station where they're kind of breaking it down.
Okay.
Give me one second.
All right.
I tried to watch the video. I didn't get a good view of what was going on.
I didn't see the video. I just read the story.
Because there's video. The video that I saw, you could see like a little in the background, but it was mostly on like Dan Quinn. And Dan Quinn was dapping people up.
Right.
Bad blood was on display during the game and after. Oddly enough, between Sirianni and former Eagles tight end Zach Ertz. The two had to be separated during post-game handshake. Sirianni didn't have much to say about it after the game.
What was the nature of the interaction with Zach Ertz after the game? It looked like he was pretty...
Congrats, both of us say congrats to each other.
Ertz told an Inquirer reporter, I'll let him comment on what was said. To me, we just exchanged holiday pleasantries and kept it moving. But according to sources close to the incident, here's what really happened. Ertz went to shake Sirianni's hand, could tell the coach was agitated, so instead gave him a high five. Sirianni didn't like the intensity of Hertz's hand slap and mocked him because he had only one catch and told him he essentially did nothing to contribute to the Commanders' win. Ertz took exception and got in Sirianni's face, but the coach's escort, as always, Dom DeSandro, jumped in and held Ertz back.
So stupid, that
was,
isn't it?
That was the it like sounds dramatic so voice. Stupid.
Sirianni's so soft.
Sirianni never coached Ertz.
He didn't?
No, he did for one. They intercepted 1 year before Ertz went to Arizona.
Okay.
They crossed paths for 1 year.
I was going to say, they had to have known each other, yeah. I wonder if they liked each other when they were working together. I don't know. But yeah, so that was a pretty funny story. All right, so anyway, so Zach Ertz's score is a plus 250. All right, one more to go, Mr. Valdez.
All right, we need to juice this up a little bit.
Yes, we do.
And I'm not picking this just because of the odds. I really think this has a shot. Last week, Jonathan Taylor was the premier fantasy back for everybody scoring.
Monster.
I had a monster game, had three touchdowns, had over 200 yards rushing. I kind of see the same thing for Saquon Barkley this week. You don't know if Jalen Hurts is going to play or not. Even if he plays, they're probably not going to tush-push him since he had a concussion. So I could see Saquon Barkley getting all the goal line runs. Even if Kenny Pickett plays, I see a lot of screens, a lot of dump-offs to Saquon. It's the Saquon game. They're going to hand it to it, put it in his gut about 30 times, maybe try and break Dickerson's record. I'm going to go Saquon Barkley, 3-plus touchdowns. Oh. Three. We're going to have back-to-back weeks. Jonathan Taylor with three, Saquon Barkley with three this week against a crappy Dallas defense. I could see him running all over them. It's 9-1. Saquon Barkley, 3-plus touchdowns, 9-1.
It's plus 900.
It's 900. All right. So here's your recap for the weekend junkies touchdown parlay. Brian Thomas Jr. playing the Tennessee Titans at plus 125. T. Higgins playing the Broncos on Saturday at plus 150. Zach Ertz, of course, playing the Falcons Sunday night at plus 250. And Saquon to get at least three at 9-1. So here's your total payout on the FanDuel account. $10 will pay $1,958.75.
Hey, that's
silly. I'm going to be watching Saquon Barkley intently.
Yeah, you are.
Well, hey, split four ways? That's silly.
Well, it starts tomorrow because I got the Saturday play. So you'll be watching the Broncos.
T. Higgins first.
Come on, T.
Let's go, T. So get us to Sunday.
Get us
to sweat.
That's right.
Coming up next, it's Fridays with Feinstein here on The Fan.